So your record, let's talk about the Puddle 45, Red Rover on the A side, written by Steinberg, Pollock, and Goldberg. And the B side, Happy Like This, with the same writers. What can you tell us about how this 45 came about with these two songs?
It was the end of the run with Candy Floss for me and Gary. We had hit the bottom of the barrel with these two tracks, and we were now writing bubblegum songs.
Pete was taken by, there was a production company that is little remembered today, but was huge at the time, called Cassinet's Cats.
Right.
And they produced records by Ohio Express, 1910 Fruit Gum Company, mm-hmm. and I think some of the same people. I mean, the guy singing lead on both of those groups sounded like the same guy to me.
Yeah.
And 1, 2, 3, Red Light, and Yummy, 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 and things like that. And he wanted us to sound like that, and if we didn't sound like that, he'd find somebody who would for the record. I'm speaking of Red Rover, by the way. Happy Like This, even though it says it's the Puddle, I was not involved in that. If I'm not mistaken, is Freddie singing lead on that?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Freddie Freeman?
Yeah.
Happy Like This.
On Happy Like This.
The B-side to Red Rover by the Puddle.
Right. So who sang lead on Red Rover originally?
We all tried out. We had auditioned to sing on our own record.
Okay, but he didn't like any of those singers, correct?
He didn't like any of us. If I'm not mistaken, when we recorded that, I think it was before Jay had replaced Steve, because I remember Steve took a crack at it. We in the group, in the Puddle, there was no infighting about who sings lead on it within the group, and we happily bided our time as we each auditioned for it. But when it began to be apparent that he was going to go outside of the group for a lead vocal, we weren't happy about that.
So who did Pete Steinberg find to sing lead vocals on Red Rover, Red Rover?
He went outside the band, a fellow named Chris Skillman. He was a member of a group called 20th Century Fox, who was recording at that time at Dove. Steve Longman was engineering their track. And associated with that band, if not actually in the band at that time, were two names that became very prominent in Minnesota music later, Curtis A. and Gary Rue. In fact, I didn't recall the young man's name who sang on that. Gary Rue informed me recently that that was Chris Skillman. And he sounded, as you can tell by listening to the record, he sounded like those Cassinet's Cats characters. And we're on it. Barry, Gary, and I are singing on it. We're just not doing that lead. We're singing all the choruses. He doesn't sing with us. He's not singing on the choruses with us. That's just us. We have our little solo moments. 2, 3, 4. Chris Skillman. He ain't us.
And actually, Freddie Freeman is also on that record.
For a moment.
On Red Rover?
Yeah.
He did
the drum break.
Yeah.
He's playing drums?
No, but he's... Pete tried him out to do the lead as well, looking for that sound. And he's too good, I guess. He wanted something not quite that good as a vocal sound. He wanted that teeny bubblegum sound. During the drum break on the record, you can still hear Freddie going, "All right now, ha, hoo, ha, come on, ha."
Yeah.
Because that was cool, so he just left it.
Yeah, that whole record was cobbled together by Pete, just cobbled together.
And are the same players on both sides?
Yeah, that's Gus Dewey, Larry Hoffman, and I bet it's Rod Eaton.
Yeah, that is Rod.
So how long did the Puddle last?
With that name?
Yeah.
Year and a half, maybe?
Yeah, let's see. We left Candy Floss, and we changed our name.
After
right
we went
away?
Over to Dale. We went, because that came out of Dale's.
We went with Dale after... Yeah, after Pete, we went with Dale's company, if it was a company.
And Dale had a new name for you.
Right.
He found it in something by Edgar Allan Poe.
Right, right.
From which he got his own group name, which is Blackwood Apology.
Mm-hmm.
And I never did get the full kinetic, you know, but somehow we ended up with this name that was really an acronym. And if you look at during the short time that we were called Pretty Blue Batch, it would be written with a period after each letter.
Correct. And the letters stand for a
Philadelphia regular exchange, teetotal,
universal, experimental.
Wait a minute.
So start again.
Go ahead.
Philadelphia regular exchange, teetotal, young bells,
letters, universal,
experimental.
Mental bibliographical
association to civilize humanity.
You know, it's easier just to say Pretty Blue Badge.
Absolutely.
Wow.
That's pretty good for, 50 years ago or whatever it is.
Really?
So now there's a whole change here, right? The puddle's gone. You're a whole new band, and what's changed musically with the band?
We're playing our own instruments. We're a band. We're not a fake deal. We're real. We're playing gigs. We're playing. We're still recording, too.
And you're booked by a couple booking companies, correct?
Eventually. Yeah, eventually.
Magnum and then Alpha?
Yeah, that took a little while. We had to learn a little bit more. If you can hear the evolution a bit on our Transistor CD, the first time we ever recorded together, the five of us without any other instruments are the first sessions you hear on Transistor. Ha La La, Caveman Clubs, Drifting, and a few of those others. And you can hear that Barry and Gary are already incredible songwriters, but you can also hear that instrumentalists, to greater or lesser extent, were still woodshedding. So it took a little while before the agencies would book us,
And I understand you played pretty often at the Cafe Extemporaire, is that it?
Coffee House Extemp, yep.
At the West Bank?
Mm-hmm.
Where else did you play?
Home Bar.
You mean right away? Or eventually?
Well, either way.
Well, we have ended up being, we worked very frequently, almost kind of a house band for a while at the Home Bar. Of two or three revolving regular bands at the Home Bar, which is where Rudolph's Barbecue is now.
And CC Tap also played there?
Frequently.
We were the house band there for a month or two.
Mm-hmm. We were also the house band for a while at Duff's downtown on 8th Street for quite a while. And we played proms and, every conceivable thing that where the booking agencies would put us, and not just in the Twin Cities. We drove around.
And we were continuing to record with Dale at Mike's Side, also named Cookhouse. And
that's probably what distinguished us from the other bands in town that were sort of mid-level gigging bands. We didn't get as famous at the time as some of the other bands, but unlike any of them, we were constantly recording, a constant access to the recording studios. And that was through the talents of the two writers and also because of our connection with Dale.
Now, before Mike's Side and Cookhouse, you were also at Sound 80 in Edina, right?
Yeah, Dale took us there. Dale really worked us through four songs, Barry and Gary songs.
At Sound 80?
Yeah, he rehearsed with us, and he participated in those sessions. He was sort of like the sixth batch guy on those sessions. Those were great. They hold up very nicely. They're not typical batch. If you listen to them compared to the other tunes on Blue Sky Day, you can hear Dale's presence, and he does change the band somewhat, but they're great tracks. Tom Jung engineered them, and they sound great.
So looking at my notes, around 1970, Pretty Blue Batch turned into The Batch. So in 71, then, is when you would have started recording at Mike's Side, correct?
Sounds good, yeah.
Okay, and in 72, I understand that the both of you made a trip to Los Angeles to pitch The Batch to a number of record companies. How'd that go?
Well, it wasn't the only... We were just talking about this on the way here today, Tom. There was that specific trip where just Barry and I went to L.A. to do what you said. But there was an earlier trip to L.A. too, and during which Barry and I'm not sure who else met, that was set up to the Lou Adler thing.
So what labels did you meet with in 1972 in Los Angeles?
Barry and I took some of these tracks in 1972 that also appear at the tail end of our Transistor disc now. And we took them with us to meet with Elektra Records, which was their most successful meeting there. We also met with people at Liberty Records. We met with people at A&M Records. I have a memory of confronting the RCA building and sort of, I don't know if we actually had an appointment to get in there, though. There may have been one or two others, but those are the ones I remember the clearest.
You mean you couldn't get in RCA? Is that what you're saying?
Well, we had appointments set up for us to, you know, you don't just barge into these people, but we managed to get appointments at these various labels. And so we had some time with them. The one who proved to be the most interested was Elektra, a fella at Elektra. Wish I could remember his name. Nice guy. Had us in there several times and listened to different examples of what we did and introduced us to Harry Chapin, who was their big guy on the label at the time. Yeah, that was a nice trip.
So did Elektra want the band to relocate to Los Angeles?
Well, yeah. They. I don't know what good a band is going to do them that's, you know, in Minnesota. And it was a little bit of a, I quite honestly don't know why we didn't just say, okay. There wasn't anything really holding us back, but we were a little shy of that move. Obviously we didn't say no, but we couldn't commit to anything like that. And he just said, well, let me know when you're ready to make that move because we can work with you. And it wasn't too much longer after that that decision was made instead to go elsewhere.
Okay, so back in Minneapolis, Dale Metton has now purchased Mike's Side, changed the name to Cookhouse, and are they up to 16 tracks at this point?
Yes.
So you've got a lot more tracks to play with and record with, and you just continue to record original songs, right?
Well, we had done demos all through 1972 as well, not only on our own at Cookhouse or Mike's Side, whatever it was then. A few of those, I think, are on Blue Sky Day. I'm not sure. In 1973, we started really properly recording an album.
Okay.
Oh, and yes, the single on Groove Soup, which was Dale's label, the single of Hot Summer Nights and Golden Sun, that was done in 1972 and released in 1972.
Okay, let's talk about this. Just for the record, who's playing on these two sides?
Us. I mean, there's no session man there.
Well, we have a guy named Dick Reese playing saxophone.
Right. On Hot Summer Nights. And that's the A side, correct?
Well, that's what we thought.
Okay, so this record comes out on Dale's label, Groove Soup.
Mm-hmm.
And what happens when it comes out?
We went to various stations with Dale to shop it around, you know, for airplay. I remember walking into WWTC and not dreaming that I'd someday be working there, but at the time I was looking around, wow, we're at a radio station. The main one to move on it was KQ. But they flipped it.
Yeah. So they played the B side.
Yeah.
I guess we were thinking, as you say, as Barry said, that Hot Summer Nights, because it's, you know, peppier.
And it was more popular. It was one of our most popular songs.
So was that a surprise when you heard that on the radio?
Yeah.
I think, and I've never discussed this with Barry, but I think you agree. I think that our recorded version of Golden Sun fulfills what that song is supposed to sound like better than our recorded version of Hot Summer Nights does.
Yeah, yeah.
And so I don't think we were unhappy about it. We were just happy to get on the air.
Right.
And I remember the first time I heard it on KQ, it was in stereo. The disc is in stereo, I believe. It was exciting.
So at this point in time, this is the only vinyl 45 that comes out by the batch.
Right.
Now, I understand around 1973, you had an offer from Columbia Records to release a single called Pop and Ice on the A side. And I think we need to talk about Lou Futterman here and where he was from and what he did.
Lou was a manager-producer for Al Jackson, an R&B singer. Not sure of his name. I think it's Al Jackson. The Hello People and Jay and the Americans.
Where was Lou from?
New York.
How did you get in contact with him?
Through a booking agency that we worked out of, Variety Artists, which was a national booking agency located here, and they connected me with Lou Futterman.
So was it Lou who got a hold of Columbia Records?
Yeah.
What happened with their offer to release a 45?
Lou just suggested that, you know, I want to get an album deal. I don't want to release just a single. I want an album deal.
I think the album, too, that Papa Nice was going to be part of was about three-fourths completed. You know, so that would have been great to get an album deal. It was, the record was done already.
Yeah,
you know?
I don't think he was too happy with the rest of the material on the album, though.
He had us do then later. You're
three
probably
or four
right.
Songs.
He had us then, after we'd finished that whole album, he had us do a demo of, pick five songs and demo them. And I remember we lined up at Cookhouse in band live band formation.
Just five live songs.
Just whipped them off. Interestingly enough, I think, Blue Sky Day, the CD, not only has almost all of what was going to be our album beforehand, but it has many of those demos too. He took two songs out of that five-song demo and had us redo them in a more studio way, plus a third song, which wasn't on that demo, we also did for Lou Futterman, which is called Pretending, which I think is the Batch's single best track ever, for me, and to my liking.
Also, I believe that demo had Arnie's very first writing credit.
Not Pretending.
No, See the Man Go. What's that? See the,
no, no,
see
no,
the Time
see
Go.
See the Time Go, but that's not, that was way earlier. That was on, that's on Transistor.
Didn't
Lou... You're thinking of I Can't Take It.
Ah, yes, yeah. I Can't Take It.
Okay, so I assume that Columbia Records did not offer the band a album deal then.
No,
Okay. Now, at some point here, it looks like 1974, somebody in the band or the whole band decides it's time to leave Minnesota and head west to Colorado. Who came up with that idea?
Jay Lee, the bass player, his girlfriend moved to Colorado. So we, rather than break up the band, we went to Colorado.
But ostensibly, it was like, we can make it from there. You know, if we had this Elektra offer to go to California, the viewpoint as it was sold to me at the time, and it took some selling, I think, for most of us, was that folks like Steve Stills and a lot of major players, you know, were very much associated with Colorado, and that was where you could really do it from. And I remember thinking to myself, but they didn't, that's not where they made it from. That's where they went after they made it to, you know, sit on the mountain. But you go to LA or New York to make it. That still held true. And I think we all, or Barry and I certainly felt that way, but to keep the peace, and because at by that time, I don't think we could imagine life without being in that band. I couldn't. We went there. Plus, it was kind of exciting. It was an adventure.